Chris will be doing the intros this time. So it's time to start Webcomics Weekly.
It's a great theme.
Because we are the MacGyvers of comics.
Good point. Very subtle. Welcome to Webcomics Weekly. We are
building careers out of twine and paper clips. It's time for Webcomics Weekly.
You don't need a real gutter. All you need is a human hair and a pie plate. I am Christopher Straub of starslip.com. Across the desk from me, Scott Magic Fingers Kurtz of pvponline.com.
Didn't see me do it.
Far, far away is Brad Wigwam Geiger of Evil Inc. at evil-comic.com.
It works for me, and it'll work for you.
And doing a bit of shipping this morning is Dave, Mr. Talent, Kellett.
My ex-friend.
My ex of SheldonComics.com. Not my ex-friend.
My ex-friend.
our pre-show discussion, I think, has made Dave realize he can no longer be friends with me, and it saddens me.
Not true.
Good.
My love knows no bounds.
Dave, I can't tell you how much I have enjoyed becoming your friend over the phone the last week.
Yeah, we've had some good talks.
I know. Okay, this episode of Webcomics Weekly, I have surprises for you guys. I've made some stingers, so whenever we have a pro tip, whether it's Brad giving it or not, we have some stingers. So here is the...
Well, maybe you should save them until we actually give one.
I can't.
You got to.
I can't.
Imagine the laugh it'll get.
It'll be all the more enjoyable if you use them when they're needed.
All right, well, we do have official stingers, so I just can't wait. I'm so excited.
Good, good. Just be on it all the time.
I would also like to make a clarification. People are a little upset of the missing Webcomics Weekly episode. Apparently, it appears that episode 5 is missing. That is a misnomer. Last week, we tried to record an episode using TalkShoe's built-in recording capabilities. When that didn't work, we started over, and the numbering system automatically counted that as 5. And so it is hidden because it was a mess-up, and I haven't renumbered them. Or not. Maybe there was a magical secret lost episode number 5 that you may
maybe it's being it's waiting to be unleashed.
Maybe
still.
Yes.
Maybe that's the Easter egg.
That is our Easter egg.
Maybe.
And when you count how many times Brad laughs out loud during a podcast and enter that number, then you get the Easter egg.
Yeah, some guy listens to all of Brad's laughs and works it out, and he's like, "I've almost broken the code." And then 5 hours of work later, he goes, "I've got it."
It's like the Da Vinci Code.
More...
Mr. Wigwam, Mr. Wigwam. I figured it out.
And then he reads it and he goes, "Drink more Ovaltine." What? A crummy commercial? All right, so.
Anyway, let's begin Webcomics.
Webcomics Weekly.
Should we? Brad, you wanted to discuss something off of the top.
Yeah, we got a couple good emails on our discussion of resolution. I had dots per inch, pixels per inch, and lines per inch. And listening back on the webcast, I kind of realized that we'd gone halfway with it, but not all the way. Thanks to everybody that wrote in and provided some clarification. Lines per inch.
Whoa, is this a pro tip? Is this a pro tip? Is this a pro tip?
Oh, yeah. Let's hear a pro tip.
Oh, wait, I got to pump up the volume if it's a pro tip.
Yeah, hold on. Get that volume up.
You know it's professional when the stinger takes 10 minutes.
Pro tip, Brad Wigwam.
That was great. That was worth the wait.
All right, go ahead,
okay.
Brad.
So here's the deal. Resolution talks about the dots per inch. That's how many dots would comprise the image per inch if you broke it up into square inches. Lines per inch describes how those dots are arranged in a line and how many lines of dots would be per inch. And as was pointed out to me by several very nice listeners, the rule of thumb is that you can take your resolution, which is dots per inch, and have it divide it into two. And that's your lines per inch. So if you've got 300 DPI, your LPI, or lines per inch, would be 150. So take your DPI, divide it by two, you've got your lines per inch.
What is the practical application of knowing lines per inch?
Virtually none anymore, because anymore a lot of the printing processes that are used don't even really put that into effect, or it's an automatic thing. So very rarely are you going to be assigning a lines per inch. But if you do happen to get someone that asks you that question, what's the LPI? You just take your resolution and divide it by two.
Okay. All right.
Okay.
So that's my pro tip for the day.
Oh, pro tip?
It's time for another pro tip from Brad Wigwam.
Okay, Wait, that one
was
needs...
my laugh recorded onto the end of that stinger?
I do. This stinger has a built-in Dave Kellett laugh. Like, nobody laugh, and it's Dave laughing. Listen.
It's time for another pro tip from Brad Wigwam.
That's awesome. Now you need to fade it out at the end and make it sinister.
No, the sinister one is where I whisper, Brad Wigwam. Here.
Pro tip, Brad Wigwam.
I'm telling you, you play the first one, the time for another pro tip, before, and then you play that one after.
I gotcha.
So everybody knows it's done.
Oh, that's a good idea.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, like an intro and an outro.
Right.
Right, okay, so.
So let's press on.
Yes. Let's go to our mailbag.
Good idea.
All right, so we got a couple emails this week from folks wanting to know what, because we had talked about this, I think, at show number two or three about gutter size and the importance of gutters between panels, and how, as a preference, that we all kind of liked it. And so anybody want to address gutter size between panels?
I actually don't like a lot of gutter. I mean, I agree you need gutter. You need to have panels that aren't just a crisscross of lines. But I think when you put too much gutter, it makes it look it does something to the pacing for me.
I think I've never been really conscious of this. I'm going to look at my gutters.
I think you have pretty narrow ones, right?
I don't think they're very wide, no.
You have ones that are about the same width as mine. They're not that thick. They're
yeah.
like they're like a letter width.
Well, I can tell you what I did, and this is about as good a method as anything, is that take the 5 or 10 comics, comic strips, comic books, comic long-form comics that you like, and blow it up to the size that you like to draw at. So if you know that you like to draw by about 14 inches wide if it's a comic strip, or if you know you like to draw 10 inches wide if it's a comic page, take an existing page and blow it up and see how those artists chose not only to create their font type size, but their gutter sizes and their line widths and stuff. And it's really helpful to sort of figure out before you reduce your stuff what they did to do theirs.
Mm-hmm. And here's another thought. Some people have been sending us links to their comics saying, hey, am I doing this right? And what they've got is a big, solid black gutter, or they've got a big black line that goes all the way around the entire comic. And then the gutters are also in black. So it's as if they've taken the panels and put them on top of a black sheet of paper, if you will. That's perfectly fine. It ends up the gutter is black instead of white. I think the important thing you got to do there is make sure that your gutter width is at least about twice as wide as your strongest pen stroke. In other words, if you're drawing with a two-point line, for example, your gutter has got to be at least 4 points wide, because you want to make sure that none of the drawings that are being made out of black line inside the panel are going to get confused for a gutter. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
I agree. I'm actually looking at your at Evil Ink, Brad, mm-hmm. and I have an interesting observation. I think that your gutter width, as given, I think it's too wide. But the thing is that you've got word balloons that go outside those barriers, and you've got sound effects that also breach those lines, and you need that gutter width in there. And I like that.
I tried with as possible, yeah.
But remember, though, that Brad's work is also being reproduced in print at a much smaller size than you're seeing here, mm-hmm. you know?
Yeah.
Oh, that's true.
And then when I put them into books, I do a whole lot of reconfiguration of them. So that extra gutter kind of comes into play there as well.
Huh. Oh, that's right. Where you arrange them.
Yeah, because then they get put out like a graphic novel instead of a collection of comic strips. So a lot of times I'm doing that right in InDesign, and I'm, you know, bringing my image box in tight, and I've got a little bit of wiggle room there.
Yeah.
Now, one thing, Chris, that you do that I noticed over at Starslip is your borders, this is kind of related to your gutters, but your borders you intentionally did with a bumpy vectored line to give it sort of a hand.
That was kind of a cheat because I wanted people to think that I was drawing them by hand, and I thought, well, that's not directly in the picture, but it's surrounding it, so you'll get that impression even though it's not in the image itself.
But building off Brad's point, though, one nice thing that your technique does is it doesn't let the eye get confused between the border and the drawing itself, which is nice. Mm. Brad, hadn't even thought of that until you said that, and that's a good thing to consider.
One of the things I do like about Brad's borders being wider is that I find sometimes when I'm drawing panels, I have to rearrange panels because it looks like the line from one panel or a black shape from one panel is connecting with another shape in the other one, and it almost connects the images or makes the what's happening confusing, and it's because there's not enough of a gutter. Huh. Wow, I've never been conscious of this. Now I can't stop looking at it.
No, I'll never read the jokes again.
It's probably one of those things that all of us, over the years, you just slowly fiddle with, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Like, there is no cartooning school that says, well, it has to be 1/20th of the overall width of your comic is the overall width of your gutter line. You know, who knows what the... looking at Scott's and Chris's and mine and Brad just... Flipping back and through between tabbed pages here, it's interesting to see where we all ended out.
Actually, now I'm thinking of something interesting that would only apply to people who are using vector or sprite comics like I'm doing, where that gutter width is actually it's sitting above on the topmost layer in Flash when I do it, and that gives me room to lop off the edges of sprites and drawings that otherwise, because when you're just drawing it on paper, you stop your line, you're drawing and you stop. You know, but I've got stuff beneath that gutter width. If I hid my gutters, you would just see the edges of everybody and overlaps and lines that I drew to fill things in and stuff like that. Like looking at the back of a set dressing.
Right.
So I need them.
I'm really a big fan of your panel work because you do some very interesting things that I think I would be afraid to do. I mean, you have panel inserts. You have a fifth panel that kind of runs along the bottom and intersects the three main panels. What is your? Mm-hmm. I really admire it because I don't think I could pull it off. What's your secret to that?
Well, there's two things that kind of brought that about. I started working on Fables where I had a full page, and I really was getting interested in page design in terms of comics. And I saw that there was a lot more that you could do other than just putting these comics on a grid. And the other thing is a lot of times, as you guys probably have noticed just doing this podcast, I take a little while longer to get to my point. And as much as I preach solid editing and stuff, sometimes I'm not so great at that. And I found myself in a situation where I was a lot of times writing what amounted to a five-panel strip. So I racked my brains, how am I going to get that fifth panel in? And I realized a lot of times I can do that just by making this panel that was maybe a fourth of the size of a regular panel, making it circular, and then floating it in between two regular rectangular panels. And once I started doing that, then it opened up a whole avenue for me. Sometimes I did, like you said, some of these long horizontal panels and stuff like that. It takes a little while longer to kind of work that out and make that so you don't send the reader the wrong direction. But
yeah.
It really is a nice, it opens up your storytelling a whole lot.
Well, I'm looking at a panel that you've got here where you have the you have an extra panel, a low horizontal panel that's tucked away into the skyline where there, you know, you don't need to just fill in straight black. for your skyline, and you don't need to litter it with lit windows or whatever for that panel. You may as well put an extra panel in there. I like the fact that if you've got a small bit of dialogue and maybe a head or a close-up, then you can tuck that inside of another panel.
Yeah.
And not worry about eating up space that you might need for something else.
I never thought to do that. I'm going to start playing with that.
And it also, you guys, you're going to find if you do this, it also helps you pace the joke a lot better, too. You can add that extra half a step to build that suspense a little bit more, and it's really good for that.
That is cool.
Yeah, I'm seeing it. I'm starting to find some Evil Ink panels where you did this, and this really is a good technique.
Yeah, thank you.
It makes it very comic pagey, you know?
Well, and that's the other thing. We were talking earlier about the graphic novels. It makes it a lot easier when I'm putting these together into a graphic novel setting. I don't have to do as many tricks. Some of them, I can just put them in the way they appeared, and they take their place on the page, and I don't have to do anything to them. They already look like they're that part of the page. You know what I mean?
Right, right, right. You know what's funny is when we start talking about this sort of stuff and we notice something that one of us is doing, it's funny how we sort of turn into those 1950s advertised housewives. Like, Brad, how do you get your muffins so fluffy?
He knows how you promised you were going to talk about my fluffy muffins.
Gosh.
We had an agreement. We had an agreement. The judge said you would never talk about my muffins.
That's a restraining order.
That's
why this
one.
Show isn't done in one room.
Jeez. Brad and I need to be a coast away.
Right. Well, I think that covers gutters. All right,
should we move on to the next topic, fellas? What do you think?
Yeah.
All right. Here's an interesting question. Let me see who it was. It was in regards to our studio setup and what do we have in our studio to do our daily job. Let me see who this was. A question from... I think it was from Jimmy Rains of Heartland Comics.
Scott, just an aside, we need to work on another stinger for when we're done with the topic. You need to have one that goes like, nailed it.
Like, well, here, let
like
me
we
listen.
Got it. We finished that. Nobody needs to talk about it ever again.
We can do what I like to call live stingers, okay? Where I just play the stinger noise in GarageBand. It will, of course, go over there, and then you can add your little thing.
Of course. Well, then we need to do it on the next go-around.
All right. Well, let me set that up for us.
Great.
So that we're able to do it.
That's part of what you've got in your studio.
Thanks.
So who would like to go first?
Let's
hear Chris first.
My studio is here.
Next.
What's the thrust of the question is what is surrounding you on your desk? What do you need to keep close at hand?
Here's the exact question. What kind of equipment, art or office related, do you guys use? Is there any equipment you guys just can't live without? Any software that you would recommend? Computer services? What kind of backup system do you have for your computers? Any kind of brand of furniture or equipment you would recommend?
Wow.
All right, it gets a little ridiculous towards the end there. What right. brand underwear do you wear?
So we're gonna do
here's things that you'll need as a cartoonist. You'll need to go to IKEA. You'll need to go to Albertsons. You'll need to go to the gas station. You'll need to go to
Albertsons.
There's a lot of different places you're going to need to go to buy food.
No, but basic office setup. Like,
go ahead and start,
from
Chris.
A normal office. What do you guys need?
Computer. Have to have it, clearly. And I think it's just good in general. Why not? We're in the future here. Let's be honest. But I need space for my Wacom. I don't know what else to say. I could talk about what pens I use when I sketch, though. You guys are all using Microns. I'm using this Statler pigment liner, and I like them a little bit better. And you know why I like them a little bit better? Because the outside of it is a little textured, and the Micron is perfectly smooth. I can get a grip on these.
I agree with you about that. They sort of use like a soft vellum plastic.
Yeah. So that's good. But what else in the office? I don't know. I used to just draw anywhere because I was on a laptop, and I would put that in my lap and the Wacom.
I can't tell you how jealous I am of that. I really want to accomplish that. I'm not kidding. I've been practicing at home.
To draw at like on your couch?
Yes.
I don't know that it's a good thing, though. Because I like the idea that now the couch is compartmentalized as this is relaxing time, and when I'm at the desk, that's work time.
Well, what I have is I had to take my laptop and set it up to a monitor and at my desk so it feels like it's a normal computer so far to make it work.
Yeah.
I have not been able to just hold the Wacom in my lap and sketch. I'm practicing because I'd really like to be able to do that.
I actually was better at that than at using it at the desk. When I was first sitting here with the thing in front of me, I wasn't doing good drawings.
Hmm.
I was kind of blowing it.
Really?
Yeah. I felt shaky.
So just, Chris, give us a breakdown of what it is you use. I mean, you're all digital, so your setup is essentially your computer and your Wacom. That's it.
Yeah, and I work in, and I need Flash to actually do the drawings in. Although, I have been made to understand recently that Manga Studio EX is Vector, and I really want to look into that.
Huh.
Because they have the digital Zip-a-tone, you know, in there, and I would love to see how that works out, because that's why I don't use gradients in Starslip. I don't like that idea, but I would use some kind of a hatch or something.
Yeah, all of a sudden in the last week or two, I've heard of like four or five people using that Manga Studio. There's a pro version which costs umpteen $100 and,
ooh,
the cheap version, which costs like $50, right?
Right.
Well, I emailed the guys at Manga Studio, and they were kind enough to send me a free license for the Manga Studio Pro. I have to tell you, it was very difficult to install, at least on the Mac. It was just so unintuitive to install. There are several libraries of textures and patterns and screens that they, you know, were just very, I don't know. It was very difficult for me to install it. But now that I have it installed, I really need to sit down and play with it. And I'd love to give a review. But Chris, you were telling me that there is there's a video.
Oh yeah, I wonder where we could post that. If it's on, well, clearly it's on YouTube. We'll put it up on the Webcomics Weekly.
We'll put it
page.
In the show notes. I'll put it in the show notes for this, so you can go to TalkShoe and the information of this show will be the link.
It's Meredith Grand, who made a video of herself drawing Octopus Pie, her webcomic.
I'd love to see that.
And she's using Manga Studio.
Oh really? Okay.
And that's why after I watched that video, I went, "Wow, that is awesome." And the interesting
Meredith thing, has a great style.
She does. The interesting thing about her video is that she drew that thing like three times. She drew a really rough, like a thumbnail, you know, at regular size, and then she cleaned it up, and then she cleaned it up again and did the
you know
actual
what?
Line
that's,
work.
That's a person that comes out of animation training, I think.
Because
a normal comic, a person that taught themselves to draw usually does a pencil sketch and then is done with it with the ink sketch. But like an animator will do a sketch because they're so quick. They've been trained to be.
Well,
you
could see that she was really concerned with panel flow. And I'm not just talking about between panel, but like where objects are placed on the left half of one panel versus the right half of the other panel. So it visually, you know?
Right.
A lot of work went into it. Too much work, I think, actually. I will never do that much work. But what else?
Cut to Chris, like, copy, paste, done.
Ding! There it was. But other than that, I don't know what else to say. And Photoshop must have it. Need that.
All right. So
I think you guys would have a more diverse set of tools in your studios.
Well, oh. I can do the opposite of yours, which is all bitmap and paper, if you want.
Well, sure. Yeah. Everybody should do one.
Okay, so my setup involves two desks. One is a really cool old wooden drafting table that I bought off an engineer for $50. And then I cut out a hole on the top of the drawing or the drafting table and built in a light box so that from underneath I can just flip a switch and my desk becomes a light box. And then on that desk I draw with Strathmore Bristol vellum paper. I find to be sturdy and archival and non-acidic. And then I use Micron pens and Pitt, Faber-Castell Pitt pens, which are fantastic pens, beautiful ink. And then I also have this Japanese reservoir pen, which is a brush that's filled with India ink when I really need to put down a sea of black. And then I use a rubber eraser, get rid of all the pencil marks after I'm done, scan it in on a Microtech 9800XL scanner, which is a Gigantor thing, use Photoshop to clean it up, and then post it online. So that's pretty much my studio. Brad?
Mine is awfully similar to yours. I started out drawing on a homemade drawing desk that my grandfather had made for me. And when that had finally gotten too wiggly and wobbly to use any longer, my in-laws, I think for Christmas a few years back, got me a architect-sized drawing desk and a light box. So that's similar to yours. Sirius satellite radio, I couldn't do it without that. I work off of a iMac. Pens, again, similar. I use Pigma Microns, although I got to tell you, I don't know whether this is just me being like against the grain, but I'm a real fan of the Canson Bristol board, C-A-N-S-O-N, and I like the plate smooth. I think it takes the ink so much more smoothly than anything else, even the Strathmore that I've bought.
Huh.
Scan it in on a, what did you say you had, a Microtech? Yeah, I've got a Microtech too, ScanMaker i700. It's a 8x14, so I can scan everything in one fell swoop.
Nice.
And then I bring it onto my iMac, and I'm good to go.
Yeah, and I also do iMac. I should have mentioned that. And then, Scott, what's your process?
We kind of talked a little bit about Photoshop and some options and so forth, and I think a little bit of this conversation was going on the forum too. For me, it's got to be Photoshop. I don't think anything touches it, but it's so darn expensive. It's hard to make that jump. I just want to put this in the back of your head. Photoshop Elements is about $100, and it's got almost everything that a daily cartoonist would need. There's a couple things that fall short on, but for the most part, if I had to, and if I didn't have Photoshop, I could use Photoshop Elements to do everything that I would need to do.
Hmm. Yeah, and I don't use it myself, but some people have claimed that the GIMP is a pretty good alternative. Have any of you guys ever tried it?
Isn't that Linux only?
That's Linux only, right?
It's only Linux?
Yeah.
I've never tried it, but that's freeware, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's free.
It's free. It's basically Photoshop for Linux.
Oh, okay. Well, no wonder I haven't used it.
I downloaded some two new programs that are Mac only recently. I actually got a free license from one of them. One of them's called Acorn, which is at flyingmeat.com. The other one is Pixelmator, which is at pixelmator.com. Both of these are wonderful photo editing pieces of software. I mean, they've got layers and masks, and they can open Photoshop files. But for doing a comic strip, they are a no-go. There's no mode change on them. There's no way to import from your scanner. There's no Twain import. These were wonderful programs, but they were really designed for photo editing and touching up. And I was really hopeful that since one of them is $39, the other is $59, that they would be great. But I know that Acorn has an open API and that people are writing plugins for it. So maybe in the future, some plugins that will make it more accommodating to webcomics people will be added for that.
Yeah.
In the meantime, I'm not a...
Well, in the
I'm
meantime,
not a,
for listeners that want it, don't forget the pro tip that you can just write the makers of Manga Studio and say you're Scott Kurtz and then get your free license. So that's
a good pro tip.
That's a good pro tip.
That is a good pro tip. In fact...
I'll be sending off that shrouded email with that later today.
Pro tip, Bradwick.
Jeez.
I will just be masking my ISP and sending off that email today.
I learned that.
Hey,
from,
I'm Scott Kurtz again.
I learned that from you, Dave. I mean, seriously, you taught me it doesn't hurt to ask.
It doesn't. It never hurts to ask.
And I asked specifically Gus Mueller, the maker of Acorn, if we could review it on our podcast. So I need to play.
Well, and look, the folks from Manga Studio, if they want to send all four of us, and I say this not in a self-helpful way, but basically because I'm in love with Photoshop. But I'm happy to review it on here if you guys want to.
Well, he sent me a thing, Dave. I'll just send it to you.
Oh, all right, never mind.
Yeah.
Because I would love to give an honest review of it, because I know the pro version is expensive, and it would be interesting for because it's made for cartoonists. It'd be interesting to see.
Yeah, we really need to. We really need to play with it so we can come back and.
Well, that's what I mean. Like, we all go away, play with it for a month, and then come back and say, "Well, here's what I couldn't do with it. Here's what I really could do with it."
Yeah.
All right. Let's go. Let's,
next.
So I think
it's me, right?
So should we go on to the next question?
Did I have to do mine, right?
Go ahead. Okay. Yeah, you're kind of in between.
You know, I'm not so much in between anymore, but like before I moved to this office, when I was working at my house, my office consisted of my Mac Pro and Wacom tablet, which I never used the Wacom tablet at all, and a scanner. So and behind me was my father's that I inherited from my dad, his 30-year-old solid maple Mayline drafting table. It's my prized possession. So I would draw my strips there. Jump over to the scanner, scan them in. I did everything but the word balloons and filling in the black areas. I would scan it in and then use Photoshop to fill in the black areas and then add the text. Then later I streamlined it to, I didn't even bother with panels drawing. I just drew the figures. And then I had, on my computer, I have a setup of panels. And then I would drop and arrange, scan in the figures, drop them in and arrange them in the panels however best it worked. Then when I was in Seattle last year, Mike Krahalik over at Penny Arcade introduced me to the secret of working with a Wacom tablet and unlocked for me the secret of drawing a line on that tablet and having it match what's on the screen, and that is being zoomed in very close to the line and not being zoomed out. That's how you get those smooth lines. And ever since then, I've been going more and more paperless. So right now, my workspace consists of a little table, a half-T table from IKEA with my Mac on it and my Wacom tablet. I have instead of having my 11 by 17 scanner, which I used to have, I have a little, I've mentioned on the show before, a little 8.5 by 11 scanner. I just do basic sketches of the characters. I mean, it's very rough. Scan that in, arrange them in the panels, reduce that layer that the characters are on to about a 15% opacity, and then I ink directly over the sketch. So all my inking now is done on the computer. And a lot of the finished art, even more and more, my sketches are becoming less and less detailed, and my finished art is becoming more and more on the Wacom side of things.
Wow.
So I'm getting really happy with it. And the great thing about it is that I've been faking line width with the Micron pens. So I was never a good user of a brush, and I don't like using Croquill pens and ink. I burn through those Croquill tips too fast. So what I would do is I would fake a line variation with the Microns. But with the Wacom tablet and the pen, there's a real line variation. It's like using a brush. And I really think my line work has come to life again because I'm no longer using the Microns. So I'm really happy with it.
It's like a really stiff brush. Brushes are very soft, and I have a hard time using them.
Yeah.
Well, I tell you what, though, being a guy that draws with ink still, when I went to brush with the our brush-esque pen, which is the Pitt brush pen, it's hard to get a grip on at first, but once you get a handle for it, it draws beautiful lines.
Yeah.
That's you know what I mean? Like, because you're too like if I draw with a Micron now, everything feels the same width and the same value, and it feels boring to me. But if I draw with a brush or a brush tip, it creates a much more interesting line.
I think. Are you talking about like a one of the Micron pens that has a brush tip?
Micron makes one, but it's terrible. But Faber-Castell, the Pitt pens, are a big black pen that has a brush tip. For the first week or so of using it, it creates a beautiful line, and then I have this Japanese brush tip. Or actually, it is a brush that I use to draw with every once in a while, and that's really beautiful, but hard to control. But you're right, Chris. They're unwieldy, but boy, once you get used to them, it takes a couple months. But once you get used to them, boy, they're great.
Yeah, the thing is, it requires so much like wrist control, because you touch that paper, and then suddenly you've got the thing fully on there, and your line is as wide as a pencil eraser.
I would like to add one thing to this discussion about office setups, because I think it's really important. when you're working and trying to get a lot of work done, I think what's in your office environment as far as distractions is very, very important. I have moved to this office. There is no television, no cable TV. The internet's bad enough. We're in a pretty Spartan little room here. And the most work I get done is between the hours of, I would say, 7 a.m. and 10 a.m. Because there's nobody calling. There's no phone. There's no distraction. There's no TV. There's nothing to do but your work. And it seems silly, like, well, yeah, you say get rid of the distractions, but if I get bored, I'll find a distraction. It really is. It does make a difference. I mean, when I was at home, all my stuff is there. Every distraction I could think of is there. I'm here at the office. There's nothing else to do. So I'm not saying you should get your own office, but one thing I was considering is taking your work and going to a library. You know, get out of your house.
Yeah.
If you can cross that mental threshold, get out of your house, go to the library, hit it in the morning, or hit a diner, someplace where you can find a little corner, a little booth, a little workspace where it's quiet and there's no distractions. I bet you can get a lot done.
Boy, I can't underline that enough, especially the TV part. A lot of people will have the TV on and they'll convince themselves that it's background noise and this and that. And I'll tell you, you've got to get rid of those distractions.
It's huge. It is fundamental.
You know, it's funny because at first I always used to wonder why I did some of my best cartooning at like 1 or 2 in the morning. And eventually I did realize that same thing that you did, Scott, which is no one's calling me. No one's asking me to do anything. No one's there's no expectation that I might suddenly have to get up from my desk or anything.
Yeah.
And so I just put my head down and draw for 2 hours. And it's great. Love it.
Mm-hmm.
All right, next question.
So one other thing that I would recommend for people starting out, or if, once you start to get a certain amount of scanned work, is make an investment. It's very cheap comparative to what it used to be, but an external drive to store your work at least one other place than on your computer.
Oh yes, absolutely. And I just purchased for about $120-$150. This wonderful portable Western Digital hard drive. I carry it with me back and forth between the office and work. It is great. And there's a program on the Mac called Super Duper that does total backups. It is fantastic. I can't recommend it enough, but back up your work.
Mm-hmm. And where do you guys...
Can we go back? It's called Super Duper?
It's called Super Duper. I mean, there's a ton of...
The reason why I ask is I bought Retrospect recently, and it's terrible. I can't get the damn thing to work.
What program?
Retrospect.
Huh. Well, Super Duper... Let me look up Super Duper.
While you're doing that, I got a quick question.
Yeah.
You guys who are working on paper... Well, I guess that's only you and me, Dave. Where how do you store your originals?
That's a very good question.
I store it in individual boxes that I then mail to fans that have bought it for $80 a pop. Phew! Nailed it.
I store my originals, because the sales of my originals is becoming a significant chunk of my income. My living terror is that I'm going to have a fire at the house and I'm going to lose 7 years worth of strips. And one thing that I'm thinking about is buying one of those 5-foot-tall, 6-foot-tall fireproof safes, because the potential income from those 6 years of original art might be worth a $700 purchase or $800 purchase of a safe. But anyway, right now what I store them in is, in fact, while I'm talking in pleasant filler tones, I'm going to go to IKEA.com. And IKEA has these they're little metal storage units. They kind of look like the stuff they had in the 1950s, where it's like, Margaret, go get that paper out of the shelf there. And I'm still sort of talking while I look on the IKEA site so that I can find the name, and it's probably going to be something like Splurge or something.
Just go there.
And it's going to have an umlaut, I guarantee you that.
Yeah, exactly. And it comes with meatballs. Oh, boy. it's not the Bravad. I can't find it. Oh, awkward. Anyway, imagine a shelf that is about 18 inches deep, let's say 6 or 7 inches wide, and maybe 3 feet tall, 4 feet tall, and it comes with about 8 drawers. It's all metal, and the whole thing only cost about, I don't know, 25, 30 bucks. And I have about 3 or 4 of those that store 2,000 strips in them in the last couple of years.
You are so much more advanced than I. I have a stack of 4 Sterilite plastic containers. They're actually, you know, sweater boxes. You'd put your sweaters in them and put them underneath the bed.
Yeah.
And I thought I was doing pretty good with that, although yours is your idea is much better. Because I figured inside of plastic, if there was water damage, I would be guarding against that.
But well, one thing to add to that I've recently done is it gets expensive when you buy them individually, but when you buy them in bulk, I bought a bunch of self-sealing polypropylene plastic bags that I now am going through and slowly, whenever I have a free moment, I'll go and I'll seal up 100 or 200 strips. So I'm about 500 strips into having them all wrapped in a protective plastic.
That's a really good idea.
And for an investment of, I think it's like 3 cents of a self-sealing bag when you buy it in bulk, I'll have all 2,000 strips of water protected.
So, Scott, I think we've... I was going to say, Scott, I think we've vamped for you long enough. Have you come up with the software?
It's at shirt-pocket.com. Super Duper is the name of the program. The thing that's great about Super Duper, I'm afraid this is Mac only. Sorry, guys. I don't have a Windows solution because I've just not been using Windows for the last year. The thing I like about Super Duper is 2 things. Everything that it tells you is in layman's terms. For example, before you do anything, this window pops up and it says, what's going to happen? Pressing copy now will use backup all files and copy everything on Macintosh hard drive to your backup volume. All files on your hard drive will be copied to your backup volume, except temporary and system-specific files that Apple recommends excluding. So, you know, you don't have to wonder, what am I doing? And once you've copied everything, you can then set it up to do periodic updates where it only copies over what's changed. So
that's beautiful.
If you've erased something, it'll erase it on your backup. If you've added something, it'll add something. If you've changed a file, it'll copy over what you've changed. The best part is you can tell it to make that external drive or that backup drive bootable, and it copies over everything. So let's say you come into one day to your Mac, and it's horked on you, and you don't know what to do. Your hard drive's gone crap. Plug in your portable, and it'll boot off of that drive. It makes that backup bootable if you want it. And it's a $30 program. And it comes very highly recommended. It's called Super Duper.
And it's Super Duper.
And it lives up to its name.
It does.
Hey, and on a side note, after searching the IKEA site, I found the name of the drawer unit that I use. It's called the Helmer, which is H-E-L-M-E-R, and it's $39.
Helmer.
Is there an umlaut?
Hey, you know
and
what,
there's
Dave?
No umlaut.
I remember.
Are you sure you're at IKEA?
We've got Helmers in the office. That's what these gray things are.
Is that what these are?
Yeah.
Oh.
I guess
so
they really are good.
I have 4 of those that store my originals.
They work well.
Nice.
So for the cost to me of, let's see, they're $40 each. Quick math, $160. I have all my – and the nice thing is I went through – because I have all my strips dated on the back, each drawer is dated like September 3rd, 2005 to May 5th, 2006. You know, that sort of thing.
Nice.
And so when someone buys an original, I go over to the drawer. I pull it out. If it's sealed, then I slide it into a protective mailer and off it goes.
That is sweet.
Pretty sweet. All right. So next question. This question comes from, let me go look, from Topher at inkedideas.com. And it was, did you have help along the way to get to where you are with your comics?
Wow. That's a big yes.
Yeah, absolutely. Yes.
And I think, just speaking for the group, that's half the reason that we keep meeting here every Friday to record this, is that, you know, in a certain way, I mean, it's sappy to say we're giving back, but, you know, we've each been helped by somebody in a really tangible way. And we realize that it's important to keep that going and to kind of, I guess, pay it back, you know? Am I being a sap?
No.
I mean, yes, you are a sap, but not in that case, no.
What was the most significant piece of help that you guys got when you were just starting out that it really made an impression on you?
Wow, that's a good question.
Oh, that's easy for me. A couple things. When I was first showing my artwork to people, I bumped into Jeff Smith, who's doing a book tour in Dallas. This was late 80s, early 90s, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
It would have to be...
This was in the
90,
past?
It was 91, 92. I was just out of college, I think. And I asked him, Jeff, what do I need to do to break into comics? What do I need to do to be an independent comic publisher? And he got very angry, and he said, I don't like answering that question, because when I answer it honestly, the people that I give the answer to don't like my answer. Because the answer is, if you have to ask, then you have no business trying. This involves research, business plans, raising capital, and it's a lot of work, and it's not fun. It's not the creative side. And if you are in here asking me at a shop how to do it, then my response to you is, don't. You're not ready. And I left that, that little signing so upset, and like, screw Jeff Smith, I want to do it. He doesn't know me. But that stuck with me. That stuck with me for a long time, and I don't think he realized it, but Jeff Smith really helped me out by saying that.
He's right, though.
Oh, he's absolutely right. Then the next people that helped me out was when I was doing when UGO went belly up and I had to get some financial legs under PvP. I wanted to publish it as a comic. I did not know how to enter into the self-publishing business very well, and John Kovalik was instrumental in helping me. He had already kind of done the groundwork with his comic Dork Tower and set up Dorkstorm Press, and he let me come in and learn the ropes about conventions and stuff. So, you know, and Frank Cho helped me get into Image. Sergio Aragonés was nicer to me than he needed to be at San Diego 2001 and gave me advice. Told me my work was good enough to be on Cartoon Network. So there's just hundreds of people that helped me along the way.
By the way, I think we can all agree that Sergio Aragonés is the nicest person in comics.
Yes. Hands down.
There is no one nicer than that man. He is the nicest man going.
And he is great.
So I would next, as far as helped me, when I first started to do a comic strip when I was at Notre Dame and started to do a strip, I still remember, this is so lame. I was a freshman, and there was a college senior who was doing a comic strip he was a grad student, so he'd been doing the strip there for like 6 years. And so when I got the job by showing a bunch of single panel strips, I was going to start doing a multi-panel strip. And I said to him, I said, hey, so what art store do I go to buy the strips at? And he looks at me and he's like, what? I'm like, you know, with the panels and everything. So all I have to do is draw inside. And he goes, are you on crack? He sat down and was the nicest guy for the next 2 hours, showed me like the most basic thing about how to make panels on a piece of paper that worked and that flowed. And I still kind of laugh at my like 19-year-old self going, hey, where do I buy the paper? Where do I just get that cartoon paper that I just put the images on and it's all set? Ready to go. Where do I buy that? They don't sell that?
Charles and while I'm at it, where do I buy the ideas?
Yeah, exactly. Where do I put this together? And then the next guy that I'm still thankful for so much to this day for helping me out is when I was in grad school in San Diego, I sent my stuff down to the San Diego Union Tribune and said, hey, you know, occasionally I'd love to do an editorial cartoon whenever Steve Kelly has a day off. And not only did the editor say that would be great, but he like called me in for an internship to come in and work and sit in the editorial room as an intern, and I got to interview the president of Mexico and Jesse Jackson and all sorts of stuff as a cartoonist in the editorial rooms, you know, where all 10 editors sit around. And Brad, what's that called?
Roundtable?
You got it right. The editorial office.
Oh, yeah, the editorial office. Anyway, and so I got 2 days a week. I got to do Saturdays and Mondays when Steve Kelly took days off for a year as a college grad student. And that was amazing to me. And at that point, the San Diego Union was getting, I don't know, 500,000 distribution or 600,000 readers that were taking the paper. So for me, that was just – that was such a kindness on his part, because there's so few ways that a cartoonist can break into the business. And that was his way of giving back, I think. And I am so thankful to Bob Kelly for giving me that break. And then to a lesser extent, I'm incredibly thankful to, it sounds so cheesy to say, but to you guys and to about 20 other cartoonists online who have been very giving with just tips and tricks and help along the years. I mean, we've all sort of been learning from each other, I think, as to what works and what doesn't in what we do.
Mm-hmm. We're certainly doing that now, I think. I'm learning from you guys. In the last couple of months, I think I've learned more about webcomics and refocusing on my business than I have in the last 4 or 5 years of doing webcomics.
I was going to say, I mostly learned from you guys, and even I would even say from the three of you, you know. I mean, I had a lot of good experiences at Con.
We are fantastic.
We're great.
You know what? I would be the first to say it. I love you guys. You guys are beautiful. I love you so much. Come on, reel it in. Reel it in for the real thing. Come on, bring it in here. Come on.
I'm sorry.
I've got a similar story to Dave's, and that was when I was in college. I was at a it wasn't an art college, it was a liberal arts college, and my bachelor for the bachelor of fine arts degree, my entire senior thesis was my cartoons. So they brought in the editorial cartoonist of the Detroit Free Press, which at the time was Bill Day, and he was one of the jurors on the show. And a great guy. He came in for the complete day, took me out to dinner. We did nothing but talk shop. It was the first time I talked to a real live, honest-to-goodness cartoonist. And he really was complimentary about my work. And I said, well, you know, where do I go from here? And he said, listen, kid, if you want to be an editorial cartoonist, forget it. There's 150 jobs. They're all filled. The only time anybody moves up one is when somebody dies. So he says, what you want to do is you want to get into a newspaper as a graphic artist. It's a good job. You get good benefits, good pay, and then submit your cartoons on the side. And that's been my career since 1991. And it's done a wonderful job of paying the bills. I don't know that I'd recommend it to anybody now, but to get me to where I am now, it's been very good. And I've been able to do a tremendous amount of cartooning at the newspaper. And the other guy, without becoming too much of a sap, wrote me this email. It's the oldest email I've ever kept. It's literally number one on the inbox, saved messages. Says, Brad, you need to call me sometime. I would love to talk shop with you. Your art continues to impress the heck out of me. Drop me a line sometime. I'm just sitting here anyway. And I got more mileage out of that email. Every time I felt, you know, really kind of like I was second rate, I'd literally open that up and read it again and know that that's what Scott Kurtz thought about me. And
what?
That got through a lot of tough times.
Come on. What are you talking about? What did the email say?
I've got
say?
It saved right here.
Read it.
And I'm telling you, there's been so many times that I'm like, Geiger, you're just not good enough. You know, maybe it's time to hang it up. And I'd go back to that and I'd say, no, I impressed Scott at least once.
Oh, stop
it.
What did the email say?
It said, you need to call me sometime. I would like to talk shop with you. Your art continues to impress the heck out of me. Drop me a line sometime. I'm just sitting here drawing anyway.
That's great.
That feels actually feels very familiar to me.
I
must
email.
Have heard that before.
The first email I ever got from Scott was, hey, you still owe me the $5 from loaning you for a hot dog at Comic-Con.
Oh, man.
So you got a much nicer one than I got.
I thought you were going to say, he sent me the same email, too. And then Chris goes, me, too. Wait a minute.
It's dear, a templated email you just sent.
Dear cartoonist, I really enjoy your work.
And then all of a sudden I go, I'm out of here. Poof.
Pro escape.
Pro escape. But Scott forgot to delete some sections of the copy paste. So it's like, I really love your line art on Evil Inc. Star Slip Crisis. And then you're like, wait a minute.
On Star Slip Inkdun.
Inkshildun.
Inkledun.
Yeah, you know, there was that little PS at the end that always bothered me, Scott. It said, keep up the great work. I love the duck. Maybe you can insert a lizard at some point. I never really...
Oh, my God. Well, Brad, I hope I could continue to be an inspiration.
Inspiration, friendship,
inspiration.
Insignia, birth insignia.
I hope that I can continue to be an inspiration, insignia, birthmark.
So, Chris, have you answered this one yet, as far as who was the big influence on you?
I'll be honest. You guys are really it, and a handful of the others. And
No.
But here's why. It's not just that. Like, I didn't have those experiences where I would go up to somebody at Comic-Con where I revered them, and then I, like a Jeff Smith or somebody like that, because I would go, you know what, though? They get that all the time, and I don't know what I would say to them and stuff like that. So I've never done that. So all of my experiences that were positive with cartoonists are other web cartoonists. I didn't come at it from the same angle. I have lived a very insular, isolated web comics professional existence. But the people who have helped me the most were the ones who really loved what they were doing and did not get bogged down in all the drama and all the community infighting and all that kind of stuff. Everybody who had their eyes on the prize.
So not me.
No, you have no me at all. and where's the 20?
Well, you know what, though, Chris? If I can tag on to that, though, Chris, one thing that and kind of a pro tip, you know how you're saying you never really met somebody that you were really in awe of or like starstruck about?
Yeah.
About 3 or 4 years ago, my wife, Glow, and I had the chance to meet Bert Breathed once.
Oh, yeah.
And so I went up to meet him, and this is my pro tip, and this is why I say always be nice to everyone. Because I don't know if Burke was having a bad day or if, as I've heard might be the case, he was a bit of a jerk in general. But I went up to him with the spirit of like the 12-year-old me with the wide eyes and just the amazement, the I just want to shake your hand, you've made me who I am kind of feeling. And unfortunately, he was just kind of a jerk. And so that's why I always say to people, be nice every chance you get to every reader, every person that you meet, other cartoonists, because that unfortunately has left a lasting impact on me about what Burke Breathed is that I have this 5-minute memory of talking to him where he was just a jerk.
Right.
And it's so unfortunate because I don't know if he was having a bad day and I don't know if he was having a good day and I don't know if that was his personality. But it left me with this sort of tainted impression of him, which was unfortunate. Because, like, for example, in contrast, I got to meet Matt Groening one time, and he gave me like an hour of his time talking about Futurama and my stuff, and we talked about Simpsons and his own troubles and trying to get certain things printed or on TV. And he was amazingly nice and so kind and so generous with his time. And Breathed wasn't at all, and it still sort of bums me out because there is no bigger fan of Bloom County than me, and I was so bummed to kind of have that interaction taint that whole experience of that strip, you know?
Wow.
You know, it's funny you should say that because I recently rediscovered an interview I did with Breathed. We got a hold of him a couple years ago. It was 2001. My friend Chris Jackson and I got a hold of him. And we answered him.
It was a birthday present, wasn't it?
Yeah. For my 30th birthday, so I guess it was 6 years ago. Oh, Jesus. edit out the cuss in post.
The stinger on that is, take your iron pills.
Jeez. I had asked for some abstract things for my 30th birthday, and one of them was Burke Breathed's contact information. Someone pointed out it was available online because he had registered for a website, not realizing his info was public and didn't put, you know, neutral P.O. box stuff in there. And so we emailed him and told him that his info was up and we wanted to interview him. And he says, well, if you tell me how to get that info off, I'll do the interview. But, you know, Burke Breathed has always been very, not disingenuous, but when you ask him questions and you read any interviews, he's always like, when you say, where do you get your ideas? It's not, you know, that's a good question. It's always, oh, 1,000 monkeys from a German, you know, idea farm. Come, you know, it's always very snarky and off-putting, and there's always a joke. And we asked him some pointed questions, and it what happened, Dave, the interesting thing about Burke Breathitt is he was this cynical kind of really hard-nosed, cynical, snarky dude, and then his wife kind of broke him, and he just decided, I'm going to be not cynical anymore and enjoy life, and that's when his strip ended. So maybe he had to be that way to make Bloom County as sharp as it was.
Have you ever felt that way, though? That if you're in a kind of a bad place, you write, you're more prolific? I've noticed that.
You have?
I have. If something, it's maybe not the case so much anymore, but maybe 3, 4, 5 years ago, I noticed that if I was in a bad mood, my writing was better. It was sharper. And if I was in a good mood and things were looking up at work, I'd be like, I'm in such a great mood. Everybody's going to get a piece of candy and a kiss in my comic strip. Everybody's going to win. Everybody's getting a hug and a rainbow.
That's when neighbors started keeping their kids a little closer.
A piece of candy and a kiss. Nice.
That's what I do. No, I don't. That's thoroughly covered. Topic over.
Topic smothered.
Well, you know, we do need to have that as a future podcast. Let's put that in the list for another one. Is brainstorming techniques. When is your writing better, and how can you bring the better out more often?
I wanted to do that on this podcast, but I think that is such a great topic because you get asked so often. You get asked, thanks to the Academy.
Yeah,
thanks to everybody.
Nope, I'm sorry. Listen, guys, this podcast has already gone for an hour. Let's save some for next week.
Yeah.
Good thinking.
61 minutes past our normal hour. This has been Webcomics Weekly. I'd like to thank Chris Straub sitting across from me with those ever loving dark eyes.
I'm the ever loving blue eyed thing.
Starslipcrisis.com. Hailing from Philly, the home of the teepees, it's Brad Wigwam, evil-comic.com.
Thanks, guy.
And of course, it wouldn't be the same without smiling Dave Kellett from La La Land, Sheldon.
Comics.com. You always give an email address.
You're going to give out my email?
Sheldon at.
And as always, I'm your best friend, Scott Kurtz. Oh, boy. This has been Webcomics Weekly.
Thank
you. Oh, nailed the post.
I like the idea that you're just rambling and it's just getting worse and worse. I'm your lover. How did I say that? Scott Kurtz.
I hold you caressingly sweet.
I love lamp.
I love lamp.
All right. Thanks, guys.
Hey, thank you.
I'm going to stop recording now. But don't hang up. All it's right. Time for post-show talk.
Oh, what are we going to talk about?
Nothing. Just say goodbye and stuff.
Oh, did you guys get an email from somebody who wants to interview us on his podcast?
I did.
Yeah. No.
But I don't remember.
I told him I didn't have time, but.
Yeah, I was going to say, he said that he wanted maybe to have us as a group or individually. I can't imagine.